From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you listen to someone on the radio, you always want to know what they look like, right? On today's Fresh Air, we can't show you what Noah Adams looks like, but we are going to find out a lot of other things about him and about what happens behind the scenes at All Things Considered. Noah is the host of All Things Considered. He first joined the show in 1975 as a production assistant. You can tell by his work on All Things Considered that he likes talking to writers and writes very well himself. Now he's written a book about 1 year in the life of the program. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Suzanne Vega's new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The major candidates for president are preparing in East Lansing, Michigan, for their third and final debate. President Bush prepared for tonight's confrontation with a 90-minute rehearsal at the White House, with Budget Director Richard Darman playing Bill Clinton and Chief of Staff John Sununu as Ross Perot. The president received an endorsement from some former Perot backers today, saying his campaign is moving in the right direction. Bill Clinton said he's aiming to underline the differences between himself and George Bush. Ross Perot told reporters in Dallas that he plans to just say what he believes in. The Senate Judiciary Committee's Democratic majority has demanded Attorney General William Barr approve a court-appointed independent counsel to investigate the Bush administration's handling of the bank case involving billions of dollars in illegal loans to Iraq. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Last week, Attorney General Barr tried to calm the growing storm of criticism by naming a special counsel himself. Mr. Barr said retired federal judge Frederick Lacy would have complete freedom to investigate accusations. The CIA and Justice Department stifled the fraud inquiry to cover up an administration policy of aiding Iraq before the Gulf War. But today, a majority of Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee said Barr's move was inadequate. They demand a truly independent counsel, appointed not by Barr, but by the court. Democrats argue new evidence satisfies even the strictest standards for the appointment of an independent counsel. According to their letter, this evidence supports the possibility that high-ranking executive branch officials have engaged in illegal activities by endeavoring to influence, obstruct, or impede due administration of justice. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A report assessing the economic impact of Hurricane Andrew says that most of Dade County will recover in about 3 years, but it will take much longer for the southern part of the county, which was hit hardest by the storm. NPR's Derek Riveron reports.
The report is Dade County's first detailed assessment of the hurricane's economic impact. According to the report, after the storm, the county lost 8% of its jobs. Almost all of the job loss occurred in South Dade. The report says most of the jobs will be replaced within 3 years, but they'll be relocated to the northern part of the county. South Dade won't return to its pre-hurricane employment level until early in the next century. Charles Blowers, chief researcher at Dade County's planning department, said the storm is creating hundreds of temporary repair and cleanup jobs in South Dade, but it won't be enough to offset the area's loss. In Miami, I'm Derek Riveron reporting.
Stock prices posted a moderate gain today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14 points to close at 3,188. This is NPR. Officials in Sarajevo said today that damage to the city's main flour mill could drastically increase the danger that many people will die from starvation in the Bosnian capital. Sarajevo's flour mill and bakery comprise the largest bread-making complex in the former Yugoslavia. Mill officials said the building appeared to be precisely targeted by Serbian gunners in a bombardment that began on Sunday. Police in Rostock in the eastern part of Germany have detained about 50 French Jews who are demonstrating against racial violence in Germany. The violence began in August when right-wing thugs in Rostock attacked a refugee center. Deirdre Berger reports.
The demonstrators are members of a group called the Sons and Daughters of French World War II Deportees. They were accompanied by the well-known Nazi hunter Serge and Beate Klarsfeld. Despite a refusal by city authorities to issue a demonstration permit, they traveled to Rostock to protest the ongoing series of right-wing attacks against refugees. In banners and plaques, the group drew parallels to the Nazi-organized murders of Jews and Gypsies. The group also protested a new treaty between the German and Romanian governments, allowing Germany to deport large numbers of Romanian Gypsies. Police arrested four demonstrators who briefly occupied City Hall. Eight police were injured when others in the group tried to free those arrested. Police later took the entire group to police headquarters. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
A new study says that states that make it easy for people to register and that try to limit the influence of special interests tend to have the highest voter turnout. The study, conducted by the Nonpartisan Institute for Southern Studies, said that Minnesota, Montana, Maine, North Dakota, and Wisconsin had the highest turnout in each of the last two presidential elections. Bob Hall, the director of the institute, said that each state had taken unusual measures to make voting easier and to control the flow of money into political campaigns. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The voice you're about to hear is one that will be familiar to you. My guest is Noah Adams, the host of All Things Considered. Over the years, his reflective interviews have brought us insights into newsmakers, writers, artists, and people around America just going about their lives. Today we get to hear a little bit about Noah's life. The occasion for this interview is the publication of his new book, Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. It's a journal of the year 1989, the year in which the program covered Tiananmen Square, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the release of Nelson Mandela. In 1989, Noah traveled to Romania to cover the fall of Nicolae Ceaușescu. In the introduction to his book, Noah's former co-host, Susan Stamberg, says that in daily journalism, you cover so many events so quickly, it can all become a blur. I asked Noah if that blur ever disturbs him.
Some days I don't care about what's going on in the news. And by that I mean, I've heard too much, and it's time to take at least a good weekend off. That's sort of a marker for me. When I don't really care, when you're talking to somebody about what's going on in Bosnia and you realize there's not a hint of emotion, you know, you should have a professional sort of overview of it, but if there's not a hint of emotion, it's not becoming real to you, then I think it's time to take some days off. I was doing a book interview one time here in this studio, a book interview with a fellow who was in New York and I was in Washington. And I'd forgotten what the book was about. And we had a call. The producer came in and said, we have a call from Tom Friedman, who has just come out of the, in Beirut, has come out of witnessing the aftermath of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Will you do that interview now? And I asked the fellow in New York to just wait. And he did. And I did the interview. And he came back on the line in New York. And he said, I just can't go on with this because of what I just heard. And I thought, well, I could have gone on with it. What does that make me? And it bothered me just a bit.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, the emotion of it overwhelmed him. He was talking about a very trivial matter in his mind, his book.
No, one of the things you're certainly known and admired for is your writing. And writing a book like you just did, is that a very self-conscious experience? Although you write every day for radio, the writing isn't getting seen by your listeners, it's getting heard. Whereas this, the writing stays on the page, it can be read and reread. Your grammar can be deconstructed. People can sit and muse and say, well, that might not be the right adjective. You know, is it much more self-conscious experience to write for the page than to write for radio?
Sure. The big difference is that in radio, you get to select the inflection investment that you bring to a word.
Mm-hmm.
And with print, you can't do that. I mean, you can't. The Washington Post, for example, I don't know if they've stuck to it, but a couple of years back, they said, okay, nobody can use italics in the style section because everybody was loading up their stories with italics. And you can't do that really in print. And so the sentence has to balance out and make sense. I find that I write for radio stuff that's really hard, even for me to read. It's just difficult because of the inflection. If you're writing very tightly, I try to. And so everything is dependent upon the inflection. In print, you can't do that. And I just found that a lot of my sentences didn't work in print at all. I worked very hard with the editor on this book. A lot of things that I have transcribed in this book didn't work on the page, and we've just sort of varied them just a bit to make them kind of come out even in print, so people at least have a fighting chance of knowing what the sentence is all about.
I know that you worked in advertising for a while. I'm assuming you wrote, but I don't really know. I know that Pauline Kael once said that she had worked in advertising, that it's good to write as an advertiser because it loosens you up, because your name isn't on the ad. So you could just write without feeling that you're going to be judged by everybody who hears it.
Huh. I hadn't thought about that. I have often thought, I hadn't thought about that being anonymous ad copywriter. I've often thought two things about my career. I think that someone once said that life is what happens to you when you're busy making plans. I'd always planned to be a National Geographic photographer. I didn't do much to that end, but that's what I wanted to be. And then I thought also that I could have been an advertising copywriter. I did a lot of copywriting back in my early days of radio, writing commercials and writing promotional announcements. And I tell young reporters these days that that's really good training for news writing. I don't have a traditional news background at all. I don't have a degree in broadcast journalism. I don't have a degree in anything. And I just sort of wandered into radio. But I think the advertising copywriting training is very good for radio. Sometimes you do it just a bit too much. You know, there's the journalistic pyramid lead, which they do teach you in school. And I've had a couple of journalism classes in high school. And that's really kind of a boring way to write. Radio, as they say, the radio writing is what comes after, is what you say when you walk up to somebody in the hall and say, "Hey, guess what happened?"
Mm-hmm.
And the person says, "What?" And then whatever it is you say, that's supposed to be the best lead of radio at all, in radio that you can use. And most days we violate that. Most days I think we get a bit pedantic and sort of newsy sounding.
You write that at workshops, you always ask, how many of you are happy with the way you sound? Are you happy with the way you sound?
Oh, gosh, no. I don't think people outside the business really understand this. I have only worked with one person who really liked his voice, and he was in broadcasting for just a few years, and he was just enthralled by the way he sounded, and he was lost. He couldn't do much. This is the truth. I leave the studio here, and when I don't ride my bike home, if it's raining or something, I will take a cab after the program. And I will get into a taxi cab, and likely as not now, maybe a third of the time, all things considered, will be on the radio. The cabbie's listening to our program on a later feed from one of the stations here in Washington. And I find, what am I going to do? I find it so painful to hear myself that I'll cover up my ears or ask him to turn it off and then have to explain the whole thing. So what I wind up doing is sort of whistling to myself. And at the same time, I'm proud of it. So a couple of times I have said, "Hey, that's me there on the radio." And they say, "Oh, yeah, well, you know," it's like, well, somebody's got to be on the radio. I just don't like the way I sound. I don't think most people do. And my attitude is, if they bring you a paycheck every Friday, then don't worry about it.
Do you remember your reaction the very first time you heard yourself on the radio?
No, I don't. I started as a rock and roll DJ, and to tell you the truth, back then I did like myself the first 6 months, because what happened to me was college didn't work out. I had to get a job. There were two jobs in the paper. One was selling shoes. One was being on the radio. The radio job paid $5 more a week, which is to say $70, and I took it. And I was on Sandman Serenade playing rock and roll music, dedications for teenagers, and that's the program that I listened to when I was growing up in my town. And so all of a sudden, I was a big-time rock and roll DJ hero, and for about a year, I thought I was just fantastic. I would listen on the way home to Clark Weber on WLS in Chicago and Dick Biondi, these big-time guys, and I thought I was as good as they were. It took about a year before I figured out, this is like anything else, it's going to take some work, and I better be just a bit humble about it.
What kind of radio DJ voice did you have then?
Well, I've tried to do it in the past. I can't get back to it. I was pretty much of a yeller. You know, that was in 1962, and I was a screamer. And my second job was pure rock and roll, and I worked in a top 40 station, color radio. The red songs were number 1 through 10. Green songs were something. And I stood up. I wore a red coat. We were in a showcase window on Main Street in my hometown. And there was a color wheel light, so when we played a red record, the red light went on. And I was a real yeller. And my voice won't allow me to do that anymore.
Oh, I mean, come on.
Well, you know, it's just an out-of-control. It's an out-of-control DJ voice. WCMI, Ashland, Kentucky. Just like that. Except it was higher back then. And I did a bit more radio. I went into to sales and management. I left radio, came back to public broadcasting, when public broadcasting came along in 1971, and by then I'd settled down a bit, and I started doing the After Midnight Progressive Rock radio program, 11 to 2 o'clock in the morning, here on WBKY, Lexington.
Well, I'm really stretching my imagination to imagine you as a shouter on the radio.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So have you done anything over the years to change your voice in any way?
I quit smoking, and that brightened it quite a bit. The people who say that cigarette smoking helps your voice or helps in anything are just being silly. But the voice was darker then, and I had a hard time having a consistent sound. It was really hard to find your voice when you smoked, and that was a difficult thing. But I did quit smoking, and that's the thing that changed it. I have a twin brother who has the same voice I have, except it's about a half octave higher, and he still has a Kentucky accent. I love to talk to him on the telephone.
How did you get rid of your Kentucky accent?
Well, there's two things. One is, there are two vowels. One is O and one is A that Appalachian people tend to pronounce as A's. In other words, you would say the word F-I-R-E is far. T-O-W-E-R would be tar. So my dad works up there at the Far Tar, or my dad's name is Hard, and he gets up every morning and takes a shower and goes to work at the Far Tar. Well, once you go on the radio and you hear just a bit of that back on tape, you realize how silly it sounds, so you change those vowels, or try to. It takes a long time to get the rest of it out. It takes a couple of years to figure out those no R in washer and dryer. And the endings of the words, you know, sometimes you drop the G's. But I think I've lost too much. I tell students today that they ought to sound like they come from someplace, I think.
What reaction do you typically get from listeners who know you only through your voice and suddenly they see the body?
It's invariably disappointment, and I'm prepared for that. And I try to make them, because they're embarrassed, I then try to make them feel better about the fact that they are disappointed. And I try to make a joke. I'm 5'5", and they have whatever it is. I mean, I could look like Robert Redford, or let's say Brad Pitt, because he looks like the young Robert Redford in this new movie, A River Runs Through It. I could look like Brad Pitt, and they would be disappointed because people, I mean, the metaphysical wonder of radio is that people have this idea of what you sound like, and you really shouldn't go out in public and dispel that, I think. I mean, I think it's better that, I think the magic happens on radio, and it's probably not a good idea to be running around out in the country too much, I think.
My guest is Noah Adams, co-host of All Things Considered. He's written a new book about the program. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Noah Adams, and the occasion for our conversation is the publication of his new book, Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. Noah, in your book you write, "I've always had a difficult time starting a conversation with a stranger, and I can never quite understand how I ended up doing it for a living." What makes it easier to approach somebody with a microphone in your hand than to go up to them at, say, a party or on the street or whatever and talk?
Well, you have an excuse, so you have a reason for being there. And for me personally, it allows me to do it, and it's a very businesslike thing. And I also find that I'm focused a lot more, and so if I'm nervous, it doesn't really show, and it's not really a problem anymore. I used to go out to do interviews on stories, and really would pray that the person I was going to go see wasn't there, and I would be able to come back to the studio and say, "Well, the guy has stood me up; he wasn't there," and. But it does seem to work out. I like to work with producers because they will go do that. They will, as I say, go up to people, and I'll talk to them. I hate to be so shy, but on the other hand, I feel that it does focus me, and I do pay more attention, and it probably does work okay, and people shouldn't worry about the fact that they're shy if they want to work in radio. Sometimes it gets really to be a problem, and I used to worry about it a lot more than I do now, and now I'm getting better, and I can walk right up to somebody and say, you know, I'm doing a radio story. Would you mind talking to me?
When was it a problem?
At the very beginning.
So what went wrong when it was a problem?
Well, I would just sort of stammer and stutter, and I wouldn't have the courage of my convictions. I recall talking to, and I still have that problem sometimes with interviews. I'll just tell you a quick story. I recall talking to Dr. Edward Teller some years ago doing a story about Star Wars, and we'd traveled. It was a long story. We'd done a lot of traveling. I'd read about 10, 13 books. I knew exactly what I was talking about. He was the last interview, and we went to his office at Stanford, and I let Dr. Teller totally intimidate me. I just let him run completely over me, mostly because he was a key figure in this thing. He recommended it to the Reagan administration, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and his opinion was very, very valuable. I think he's a fascinating guy. Well, he was very mean to me. He said to me, for example, what is the long... I wish I could do his accent, but I won't insult him by trying to do it. What is the longest... This is a very sophisticated question. What is the longest unedited answer you will use on the radio? And I said, oh, I don't know, 40 seconds. And he said, fine, ask me a question. I asked him a question. He said, no, that's a stupid question. Ask me this question. That's a stupid question. Ask me this. How was it that you thought to suggest this idea to President Reagan in the White House in the Oval Office? Anyway, like that. And he said, fine. And he had his own stopwatch on his wrist, and he started his answer and started the watch and finished at 39 seconds and said, see there, now you owe me 1 second. He said, you will not edit that answer. And I felt bad over the years that I didn't tell him exactly what I thought of that situation, hoping, and not just to be vindictive, but hoping to provoke him into a real conversation about the issue. As it turned out, we had hardly anything. We just had to put what he said right on the air, and it really wasn't a good dialogue.
It's amazing when people think they're really doing themselves a service by thinking they're outsmarting you when really they're sabotaging themselves.
Yeah, well, he may have been hurt badly, misquoted in the past.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
Noah, what got you into the door of your first radio station? It was this job ad, this once... Help Wanted ad?
Yeah. I walked in. I said, I think I can do it. And they said, well, read this sample commercial. I've forgotten what it was for. And they said, well, you really kind of have a hillbilly accent, but we think we can help you with that. And here you go. And I have never really been that drawn to radio. I've known people who had to be on the air, and they've had a hard time in their careers. I really I care about doing things well. And when I came to National Public Radio, I came as a writer and as a tape editor in 1975, and it wound up that I was going to be on the air, but I wasn't driven to it. Robert Krulwich, many people will recall him, he works for CBS Morning Program Television now, he loves radio. And he would, to this extent, he would, at night here in Washington, call up a radio talk show, take one side of the issue with one voice, and then hang up and call back with another voice and take the other side of the issue. I've heard him do it. And I've never felt that way about radio. I like it, but I like print as well. And, you know, I'd be perfectly happy doing either one, but not television. Television would just sort of shatter any self-confidence that I had.
My guest is Noah Adams, and he has a new book called Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. Among the many things that you've done in your time professionally outside of radio is being a salesman. You used to sell cars. I don't know whether it was new cars or used cars. Which was it?
Big difference, you know.
Well, probably there is in terms of selling.
Well, there's not really in terms of actually doing the job. There's a difference in the way the public perceives what you do. I sold Volkswagens at a time when they sold for one price and you took the trade-in in at wholesale, and it was a pretty honorable, I thought. To tell you the truth, I had been working for some commercial radio stations, and some of the things going on in the 60s in these commercial stations far exceeded any sort of manipulation that you would find in a car dealership at that time. I mean, like paying somebody $100 and saying they've won the treasure hunt, which was really $1,000, and you find somebody and give them $100 and they leave town. There's lots of strange things going on in commercial radio back then. And I thought that the car business was a more honorable profession, and did that for a couple of years, really enjoyed it, made some good money. But then I actually found I liked construction work much better. I was too little to do construction work. When winter came, I had a hard time with it, and that's about the time public radio came along, and I just went to the local station and said, I'd like to volunteer. I think I can do this. And they let me do a rock and roll music show at night, and then a bluegrass show, and then some documentaries, and then finally got a full-time job.
Were you a good salesman?
I was, I thought, a good salesman. Yeah. What I tried to do was surprise people. And the way you do that is you just simply, you don't say very much. And they keep waiting. People coming to a car lot keep waiting for you to hit them over the head with a baseball bat of some kind, rhetorically, and scheming to do something to them. And all you have to do is be nice to them and talk to them and tell them things that are true. And that's pretty much all it takes.
Are there any techniques from your sales days that you have found useful to being a journalist or an interviewer?
You know, when I came to this job, and I've now done well over 10,000 interviews, in that first couple of years, I recalled that business of talking to people, selling them cars, which, you have a job. You're trying to get them to buy a car. You're trying to convince them of the logic in buying it and buying it now. So there is a narrative tension to what you're doing, and everything you say leads toward a certain end, getting them to sign. And I recall being aware of that, not wanting to be manipulative in a radio interview. It's almost like, well, I know karate, so I don't want to do it. I don't want to hurt you, you know. Maybe I'm making too much of that, but I did have that feeling then that I had done this kind of thing professionally before, but it wasn't really that. This is entirely different. This is much more straightforward, and you're going to get in trouble if you start trying to figure out where you're going with this interview. If you have the story figured out, for example, when you go out to do a story, you're going to get in big trouble. And I think that's what happens with interviews.
Now, you started on All Things Considered 4 years after the show started. This was in 1975. You were a production assistant. How was the show different then than it is now?
You know, sometimes I have gone back into the tape library and pulled those tapes out because everybody says, boy, they were great shows. And every time I do it, with very few exceptions, they weren't good shows. They were 90 minutes long, and we were doing some obvious filling. We took science features from the BBC. If a reporter out in North Dakota wanted to talk to the county extension agent about a particular problem there, we would take about 7 or 8 minutes of that. We talked to a lot of people from the Wall Street Journal, a lot of people from Brookings. The programs, so they weren't nearly as good as they are now, but they had something that, you know, that was very, very special. They were conversational, they were honest, they treated the listener as intelligent and as aware. They didn't talk down to that person, and I think that's what got us through those very early underfunded years when we didn't have reporters someplace. I recall talking to a friend of mine named Stuart McBride in China. You know, you just find any reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. You'd find any chance to talk to anybody, any place, because you had to fill up that program. And that's what we forget when we think about the old days. The program was much more personal. Now, you know, it's threatened by being too good, by having, you know, great. It's threatened by being a great collection of wonderful stories from wonderful reporters, and no longer a personal radio program with a beginning, middle, and an end.
Noah Adams is co-host of All Things Considered on National Public Radio, and he's written a new book called Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. He'll be back with us on the second part of our program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, interviewing, writing, and life on the radio. We continue our conversation with Noah Adams, host of All Things Considered. He's written a new book about a year in the life of the program. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 99.9 Degrees Fahrenheit, the latest album by Suzanne Vega. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Meeting in their third and last presidential debate before the election, President Bush, Governor Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot are now answering questions this evening in East Lansing, Michigan. The first questions concern jobs and the economy, and Mr. Bush took a more forceful position than he has in previous debates as he challenged Clinton.
He says Arkansas is a poor state. They are. But in almost every category, they're lagging. I'll give you an example. He talks about all the jobs he's created in 1 or 2 years. Over the last 10 years since he's been governor, there's 30% behind. 30%, they're 30% of the national average. On pay for teachers, on all these categories, Arkansas is right near the very bottom. You haven't heard me mention this before, but we're getting close now, and I think it's about time I start putting things in perspective.
And Clinton answered the president's charge about his home state of Arkansas during Clinton's term as governor.
Mr. Bush's Bureau of Labor Statistics says that Arkansas ranks first in the country in the growth of new jobs this year. First.
This year.
Fourth in manufacturing jobs, fourth in the reduction of poverty, fourth in income increase. Over the last 10 years, we've created manufacturing jobs much more rapidly than the national average. Over the last 5 years, our income has grown more rapidly than the national average. We are second in tax burden, the second lowest tax burden in the country. We have the lowest per capita state and local spending in the country. We're low spending, low tax burden. We dramatically increased investment, and our jobs are growing.
And Perot's opinion?
It's a beautiful state. It's a fairly rural state. It has a population less than Chicago or Los Angeles, or about the size of Dallas and Fort Worth combined. So I think probably we're making a mistake night after night after night to cast the nation's future on a unit that small.
Why is that a mistake?
It's irrelevant.
Tonight's moderator is Jim Lehrer of PBS. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger says that he has called for a quick investigation of the controversy over the State Department's handling of Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton's passport files. Eagleburger made the comment after meeting with the chairman today of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Capitol Hill. Democrats have accused the Republicans of a campaign to find information damaging to Clinton at a time when his opponents were increasing their attacks on his draft record. Officials in Moscow have blamed cold weather in Ukraine for temporary cuts in natural gas supplies to other nations. Natural gas is supplied to Germany and other Western European nations by pipelines from Western Siberia. Officials say because of early cold temperatures this year, more natural gas will be pumped into the pipelines using reserves from underground storage tanks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 14 points to close at 3,188. This is NPR News. The State Department says the U.S. has accepted some 3,500 Iraqi refugees during the last fiscal year. According to spokesman Richard Boucher, these people were taken from some 30,000 Iraqis stranded in Saudi Arabia after the Persian Gulf War. He says some 35,000 refugees are still in Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. will accept some 3,500 again this year. Iraqis accepted last year, but the U.S. have been sent all over the country. In Belgrade, Serbian officials have taken control of the Federal Interior Ministry, and Serbian police have prevented their federal counterparts from entering the building. Pierre Vickery reports this seizure is the latest phase of an increasingly bitter power struggle between the hard-line Serbian president and the federal prime minister.
Last week, a Belgrade district court ruled that the Federal Interior Ministry was the property of the Republic of Serbia following the breakup of the Yugoslav Federation. On Sunday night, hundreds of Serbian police stormed the complex, disarmed federal officials on duty, and sealed off the building. The Yugoslav government has condemned the action as illegal and provocative and demanded that the building be returned pending a final legal appeal. One theory being proposed by commentators is that the Republican authorities may have seized incriminating archives, detailing Serbian government involvement in arms trafficking and ethnic cleansing, which could be used in war crimes trials. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
In Bosnia, heavy shelling of the capital has damaged the city's flour mill, thus threatening Sarajevo's bread supplies. Officials say the city has only enough flour for 1.5 days of baking, adding that many people may die of starvation. Relief officials have promised new shipments of flour, but there is concern that this will not be enough. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is back. It's the second part of our interview. He's been the co-host of All Things Considered since 1982, with the exception of a year in which he hosted the program Good Evening. From 1978 to 82, he co-hosted Weekend All Things Considered. Noah has written a new book called Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a radio journal. It's a journal of a year in the life of the program. As one interviewer to another, I wanted to know if he has any ground rules and if he tells the person he's interviewing what to expect.
No, I don't think so. I always will tell them that we are recording the interview at the moment we start, and that can be a bit disarming because you can be having a nice conversation on a satellite circuit or a telephone circuit or even here in the studio, and they're just talking to you and they're having a great deal of fun, and then if you say, okay, now we're going to start to record, they say, oh, okay, well, ask me a question and I'll give you an answer. I sort of tighten up. But no, I don't. I sort of have some rules of my own, but I don't tell people about that. I'm thinking.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm thinking about, I don't pry very much. I want people to answer the question, to be honest about answering the question, to give me a direct answer. And to that end, I'm going to do almost anything I have to do. I recall asking somebody who was a Klan leader one time why they hated black people. And it was an astounding question to this man. He was sitting in our studio with two bodyguards. And I was determined I was going to get some sort of answer to that, or at least 2 minutes of his trying to answer it that would be pretty evident.
Was he able to explain to you why he hated black people?
No, he had never been asked that question before. It was the conceit that's not what was on his mind, or that's not what drives him in the organization, and he was shocked by the question. He really was.
Oh, but by the assumption that he hated black
people,
right?
Yeah.
Well, that must have really thrown you, though. I mean, how do you get? Then you have to kind of get beyond the surface of what somebody tells you they're about and try to get beneath to what you suspect they really are about, and they're going to fight you on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it happens. I think that all interviews should be basically adversarial in nature, which is to say that I think that if somebody has one strong side of a position, that the interview should come from the other side. Tomorrow you may do one totally on the other side of another issue, but I think that all interviews should just be a little bit tense. And I'm probably not, you know, I could name 10 better interviewers in public radio than I am. I'm a bit too romantic. You know, I think everybody's great. I have to remind myself to be cynical. I wish I'd gone to law school. I think law school would be great training for journalism because, you tend to look at both sides and to try to figure out if somebody's telling the truth.
So you believe that the interview should be adversarial, but on the other hand, you admire a lot of the people you interview and you don't do the adversarial interview.
Yeah, well, sure. I've just come back. I know I've come back, especially with old men. I will just go out and make a fool out of myself with old men and old women, and I would just, make saints of them on the radio if editors would let me do that. And the editor will say to me, well, why didn't you ask this or this? And it just never occurs to me sometime because I like them so much. You know, old people who have accomplished something. And I'll go talk to them and I just think it's great what they're doing. And there'll be these shadowy aspects of their past that I never get into. So I have to watch that.
Are you ever alarmed by what you find out about a person after the interview? I mean, it's happened to me that I've interviewed somebody who struck me as a very sensitive poet. Then a week later, I talk to someone who happens to have been their student. They say, oh, by the way, do you know that he used to beat his wife and he slept with a lot of his students? And it's like, no, that wasn't in our interview. I did not know that.
Yeah.
And you feel like, well, you've given this really sensitive portrayal of somebody, and it's false.
That's what I meant by being overly romantic. That happens to me quite a bit. In fact, I had this happen. I guess we've all been fooled now. I don't know about you, but many of us here at NPR have been fooled by interviews. There was a story a few years back about a florist down in Charleston, West Virginia, who had been persecuted in his community because it was known he had AIDS. I called this man and did the interview, and, oh, it was heartbreaking. He told about going into the supermarket and having people turn the other way with their carts and run away, and having a woman drive up to his flower shop and throw a check. She owed him money, through the front door. They shunned him in this community. It was just a wrenching interview. It turned out to be a complete hoax. I don't know what was going on with this fella.
How'd you find out?
Well, we had checked it out a bit, and the state attorney general in West Virginia had made a statement, so we put the story on the air. And then 2 weeks later or three, the state attorney general said, well, this man's telling a lie, and we've all been fooled. And what I've always felt so bad about that, because we didn't make one phone call, not one, into this man's community down there near Charleston to say, do you know this guy? Is he telling the truth? Is the community shunning him? We didn't. And we got a letter, and it said, you have insulted everybody in the state of West Virginia. And I think that the letter writer was right. You know, I think we made a terrible mistake like that.
Now, in your book, you say, and I really agree with you on this, that you find it more difficult to interview people who you know, and you prefer to interview people that you don't know. Can you explain that phenomenon? Because I usually experience the same thing.
I don't know what that's about. I don't know how that works. Maybe it is that I'm just a bit too much relaxed, and maybe the things we're talking about are too well known between the two of us. I've gotten to know people who I've interviewed before and tried to interview them the second time, a second book, for example, and I find it to be difficult. And a lot of times it hasn't worked. And a lot of times I will just say, well, you know, let's go on and find somebody else. Let's find the first novel from somebody else or a new book of poetry. You don't have to interview. Over the period of time that I've been here, I've talked to John McPhee three times. And, you know, now I still love his writing, but now I'm trying to find somebody who would have been like John McPhee was in 1975. I don't want to say like a young John McPhee, but you know what I mean? I'm trying to find somebody at that level, because I'd rather just go have lunch with John McPhee and talk about what he's doing now than to try to do a radio interview with him.
My guest is Noah Adams. He's written a new book about co-hosting All Things Considered. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is my guest, and he has a new book. It's called Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. Now, you left ATC for a short time to do Good Evening, which was an evening variety show that replaced A Prairie Home Companion for a while. And I wonder what it was like for you, since you've told us that you're shy, you don't really like meeting new people very much. And so here you were on stage in front of an audience when you were really used to being alone in a studio. How did you like that?
The reason I took that job is because years ago, you know, in that period of time right when you're going off to sleep, when you're not sure if you're dreaming or thinking, I used to have a premonition about being on stage doing a comedy routine. I think it was comedy in a spotlight, darkened stage, a darkened theater. And that was so unlike me and what I was doing for a living all these years that I couldn't figure out what that was. And I wanted to go investigate it. I have had a terrible case of stage fright. I would not even, until a few years ago, would not even go talk to our friends in public radio. Wouldn't even go out of town to a public radio station reception and stand up there and answer questions, because I would be terrified. And I fought through that and tried to figure out what it was and studied it and even thought about taking, some musicians are taking a stage fright drug. I won't name the drug because I don't want to recommend it, mm-hmm. and even investigated that. I really wanted to figure out what it was. And this idea of being on that stage in St. Paul was preposterous to me until I went there and to talk to these people about it and walked out to center stage, looked out into the theater, and thought, well, I can do this and I should do it because I got to figure out what it is. And those moments, I have to tell you, those moments right before you go on the air with a program like that, right before the satellite goes up, about 10 minutes before 5 o'clock Central Time there, there would be a countdown clock going, and I would be wandering. First, I'd try to break every show business tradition. I'd go out to the front of the hall and meet people, just try to get to know them just a bit. I'd wander around, and the stage manager, Steve Kelm, would come to me and say, "You're nervous, aren't you?" And I'd say, "Yeah, Steve, I'm nervous." And he'd say, "I can have a cab out back in 5 minutes, and you can go to the airport, and you can be in Mexico in an hour, and forget the whole thing." And every week he would say that, and sometimes I was tempted to do it. I wanted to see what that was about. I also wanted to work closer with musicians and with writers and with actors and with stagehands, and I just wanted to do theater for a while. And I truly enjoyed it. I had a great, great time for a year.
Being a man of the theater.
I never got over being scared. Well, we talked about a power spot. I would ask the actors if they had a power spot. I mean, there's something really mysterious about, on stage I'm talking about, where you felt good. And I never really found mine, but we got through it. And I'm much the richer for it. I just had a great time doing it.
Was it therapeutic for you to be in front of an audience for that year?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And now I don't have any trouble talking to people, answering questions. Mm-hmm. I even sing now. There's a story that I tell.
Yes.
About singing. I'll try to tell it very briefly. We went to New York and did a story about a studio where you go in and record your vocal and pre-recorded instrumentals. And I sang Take It to the Limit and brought that tape back and played it for Susan Stamberg on the radio, and we recorded that, her reaction. We put that on the air. I sang, "All alone at the end of the evening, when the bright lights are fading to blue, I was thinking about a woman who loved me, but I never knew." Then it gets really hard. High part comes later. Susan laughed so wonderfully. I got more than 350 pieces of mail about that. Very
wow.
Serious mail. You know, I'm thinking, well, I'm a big-time journalist, but here's the mail that comes in for this. And it was mailed along these lines. It said, "My wife and I, we're 25, we have 3 kids, I'm in law school, she's in medical school, we're thinking about getting divorced, our life is terrible, but if you can do that, if you can go on the radio and sing that song in public, then we can go ahead with what we have to do." It was just amazing, the response I've gotten to that.
Bizarre form of inspirational radio.
Yeah, so I don't mind singing.
When you came back to do All Things Considered again, did you have a sense in your mind of what you wanted to be different this time around?
Yeah. I wanted to work harder with what we'd been doing in Minnesota. There's a really pretentious, I think, quotation from William Carlos Williams. One of these days I'll have to talk to a Williams scholar to find out what he meant by it. But he said, and I use it for my own purposes, he said, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is to be found there." And I came back believing that there is indeed no real difference between news and features and entertainment. Everything that happens to us in life is potentially very, very significant and very important, and should be approached in the same way. And it's the back of the book. Sometimes here, the end of the program, we sort of dismiss the features and pay more attention to the news. In fact, it's the harder thing to do, the feature material, to do the good book interview, to do the really good story about a movie, instead of just tossing it off. And that's what I came back. I came back convinced that there's no difference, that it's all the same thing.
You're out on assignment a lot. Say during the Gulf War, they had said to you, "Noah, we want to send you to the Middle East. We want to send you to Saudi Arabia." Would you have wanted to go?
Yeah. I wanted to go to the Persian Gulf War because, for one thing, it was a bit safer than some other places. I'll just tell you a quick story. I went to Romania right after the revolution, and John Hockenberry was dying to get there as soon as he could. In fact, got there very, very early. Came in on Monday, Christmas Day. That's the day that they executed the Ceausescus. And John called back to his editor here and said, tell those other guys to wait, it's not safe. I was one who was saying, you know, I've got a career and a reputation. I don't need to go in there. It's very dangerous. We thought that first weekend they were killing over 10,000 people. I was saying, let's wait, go in later. So I'm very cautious. I did want to go to the Persian Gulf War. These things pale, though, by comparison to what's going on in Yugoslavia. It could be 30 journalists who have been killed there. It's a desperate, desperate situation. I have so much admiration for people like John Burns of the New York Times and for Blaine Harden of the Washington Post, Tom Jelton of NPR, who's been in Sarajevo. It's an incredibly serious and difficult thing they're doing, and I would not want to go to Sarajevo at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to say, I for 1 week, I think it was, I guest hosted All Things Considered, and so we worked together that week. And I remember in the studio, I would have all these questions about what happens next and what do I do. And there's times when I thought, well, we'll just like sit and schmooze while this story is on. And you were so intently listening to the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just really clear to me that, you know, you wanted to know absolutely everything that happened on the program, and you felt very responsible for everything that happened on the program, whether it was your piece or not your piece. But you felt that listeners would hold you accountable, and you were holding yourself accountable.
Well, you know, the big bad thing about coming to Washington to work for All Things Considered is that you don't get to hear it unless you go home and then listen to it or come back the next day. So I want to be at least on a par with the listeners. I want to know what was on the program. And a lot of it's really practical, too. A lot of things will come in context you need to refer back to. So I try to hear as much as I can.
One last question, though. What's your fantasy about what you're going to do when you get out of public radio?
I always wanted to have a bookstore and to be some old guy with a gray, very well-worn cashmere cardigan sweater, a bookstore that had a wood-burning stove, and a cat. That's what I figured I wanted to do. I think now that I would like to be some sort of retired travel writer, you know, maybe a book every 2 or 3 years, just wander around the country and talk to people, don't worry about taping them, and have a book come from that experience. Maybe that's what will happen.
Okay. Well, it's really been fun to talk with you.
Thanks, Darren.
And good luck with the book, and thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Noah Adams' new book is Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. It's published by Norton. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, you know, we just listened back to the interview you and I recorded a few days ago, although I should say on some stations that are fundraising, we'll be playing that interview a little later in the week.
Uh-huh.
So what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Our program tonight has Deborah Wong reporting from Beijing about the announcement of China's new Politburo. Michael Sullivan from London, John Major's British government, is now backing away from its plan to shut down half of the coal mines in that country. Also a campaign speech, part of a campaign speech, a good chunk, from a talk by George Bush at Dover, Delaware. The president speaks about health care, the economy, education, and welfare reform.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Suzanne Vega has a new album called 99.9 Degrees Fahrenheit. It includes guest appearances by musicians such as Richard Thompson, David Hidalgo from Los Lobos, and Bruce Thomas, formerly of Elvis Costello's Attractions. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the sound of the album is a welcome departure for Vega.
Well, I don't know about you, but that certainly got my attention. I freely admit that I'd pretty much written off Suzanne Vega as a humorless bore and found her persona, the thinking person's waif, a true annoyance. Sure, I liked her breakthrough song 5 years ago, Luca, but I also knew it was a fluka. This was not an artist bursting with catchy hit singles. Her last album, Days of Open Hand, in 1990, was fussy and flat. It was only when a dance rock act called DNA remixed her song Tom's Diner into jittery, clever disco 2 years ago that Vega's music seemed to have any life in it. But it turns out that Vega felt much the same way I did, or at least saw complaints like mine as obstacles to be overcome in getting on with her career. Folk-based performers like this usually consider commercial ambitions to be something corrupt or debased, but to her credit, Vega's fierce desire to be something more than a one-hit wonder has now resulted in a lot of revitalized music.
I'd like to help you, doctor, yes, I really, really would, but the din in my head, it's too much and it's no good. I'm standing in a windy tunnel, shouting through the roar, and I'd like to give the information, asking for it, but blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, blood makes noise, and I can't really hear you in the thickening of fear.
On 99.9 Fahrenheit, Vega has used Mitchell Froom as her producer. He's a rock and roll technocrat known for making prickly musicians like Elvis Costello more accessible to a mass audience, and he's brought a lot of studio trickery to bear on Vega's new songs. The thing is, on tunes like the two I've played so far, Rock in This Pocket and Blood Makes Noise, the tricks sound terrific. They have the effect of making Vega's morose voice seem deadpan and witty. Froom has emphasized the best in Vega's songwriting.
As a child, you have a doll. You see this doll sitting in her chair. You watch her face, her knees apart, her eyes of glass in a secretive stare. She seems to have a life. She seems to have a life.
I suppose this album may be a novelty, a phase Vega is going through before settling back into her grim little folk songs. So I hope 99.9 Fahrenheit sells millions, and that Vega's ambitions compel her to deny her usual instincts, because the paradox of Suzanne Vega seems to be that when she sells out, she makes her most honestly enjoyable music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Heroes go down, they go down fast, so don't expect any time to equivocate the past. When heroes go down.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I heard you say you look out for the feet of clay, that someone will be falling next without the chance for last respect. You feel the disappointment. When heroes go down, man or woman reveal, you can't expect any kind of mercy on the battlefield.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the latest developments in the savings and loan crisis. There are more bank closings predicted for the near future, and whoever wins the presidential race will have to deal with it. We'll talk with Jerry Knight, who's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.